My name is Deepa O'Loughlin, and I'm the Associate Director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies, and it's a pleasure to have all of you here to listen to a speaker who I think you're going to enjoy very much. As you'll see from the title, it's Sri Lanka, post-war but not post-conflict. And the speaker and I actually spent some time thinking about what to call this talk. There were so many things that he could speak on, but we settled on this because in many ways, even though the external community seems to think that with the war in 2009, the ethnic conflict somehow seems to have magically gone away, and that Sri Lanka has gone back to being this wonderful, peaceful island that was back there in ancient times or something. And part of this is because of the fact that many journalists were not allowed to cover the war and the aftermath. There's a sort of a lot of misinformation and almost a security cloud behind which it's hard for us to pierce what's going on behind that veil. And there are also many other issues, not just a democracy issue and how it's unfolding for the Tamil minority, but also the regional implications of how the India's role has been particularly important here as well. So those are things that will be coming up, and we'll also have a Q&A after, so you know, all the things that are not covered, you can feel free to ask, because there were many other topics that we thought we might talk about, or Tissa might talk about, and we settled on this. Now, it's a privilege for me to introduce our speaker today. We don't get a lot of people like Tissa to the GW community and to the to our overall community because of the kind of experience, because of the kind of background that he has, because of the kind of experiences he's gone through. And let me just you have the flyer out here, but he is somebody in that sense a very special speaker, and it's great that he was able to get out of Sri Lanka and be here today to give this talk. He is a very well-known journalist for many years who then in 2009 he was picked up for writing an article that took issue with the government government's policy on the conflict. And it was only through a serious external pressure that he was able to get out. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He served 2 years, and he was telling us how he was himself surprised at the amount of external backing he got, but thanks to that, he was actually able to get out. He was named an Amnesty International Prisoner of Conscience in 2008, and I think that clearly got the government to sit up and take notice. And he also received the Reporters Without Borders Peter Mackler Award for Ethical and Courageous Journalism in 2009. And I think I can't think of anybody else who deserves that that award. So without further ado, let me ask Ms. Jayaprakash Tissanayagam, or Tissa for short, to take the podium. Thank you.
You can just stand here and talk now.
Just make sure this is. And, well, this goes forward and this goes
back. Oh, great.
Just speak into
it. Thank you. Thank you, Deepa, for that very kind introduction. Chairman Professor Deepa Olapalli, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to speak to you this afternoon. The topic for discussion today is Sri Lanka, post-war but not post-conflict. We should be aware of that distinction. Post-war, post-conflict. Post-war would mean absence of active warfare. Post-conflict would mean that the drivers of conflict that created the warfare in the first place have been eradicated. The theme of my presentation is that the civil war in Sri Lanka that took up the better part of two decades is only one aspect or a single phase of that conflict. And just because that there is no armed warfare today, it does not mean that there are no grievances causing deep-rooted, divisive conflict that continues to bedevil the country, its people, and its institutions. In fact, in at least two ways, the conflict in its post-war phase is more insidious than when armed combat was taking place. One, because with no robust Tamil opposition, the singular ruling elite that controls the state apparatus is able to impose its vision for Sri Lanka's future as one which is dominated by the Sinhalese, with minimal role for other national groups that share the same political space, that is, the Tamils and the Muslims. Second, because armed conflict has come to an end, the Sri Lankan conflict hardly attracts the attention of the international media. With very little international media coverage, international public opinion on the conflict, sparse even when fighting was going on, is almost non-existent today. This allows the Sri Lanka government to operate outside the scrutiny of informed public opinion. The civil war in Sri Lanka came to an end in May 2009 with the military defeat of the Liberation Tigers of Tamilula. It was followed by the international community calling for reconciliation between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. It is important that the call for reconciliation was not imposed from outside upon the Sri Lankan political leadership. It's very important to remember that. That Sri Lanka accepted the importance of reconciliation is reflected in the words of Sri Lanka's President Mahinda Rajapaksa in an address to the National Parliament soon after declaring victory over the LTT. He said, and I quote, "Our intention was to save the Tamil people from the cruel grip of the LTT. We must now live as equals in a free country." Close quote. But today, 3.5 years later, there is hardly anything to show that reconciliation between the Sinhalese and the Tamils has progressed. The report by the International Crisis Group issued last month draws attention to this fact, and I quote again, "The Sri Lankan government's refusal to negotiate seriously with the Tamil leaders or otherwise address legitimate Tamil and Muslim grievances is increasing ethnic tensions and damaging prospects for a lasting peace." Close quotes. The ICG is not alone in making this observation. There are many others too. The question is, what has gone wrong? I feel that if we are to understand why there is no reconciliation today, a good starting point might be to look at the government's post-war pacification program in the countries north and east. The Sri Lanka's north holds a Tamil numerical majority. The east has almost two-thirds Tamil speakers, that is, the Tamils and the Muslims who speak Tamil. To my mind, the government's pacification has two important components. One, militarization, and two, resisting sharing political power with the Tamils at whatever cost. I will deal with each in turn. When I say militarization, I mean using the military as part of a political agenda to render the Tamils powerless as a community. According to the ICG, which has undertaken a well-documented study of militarization of Sri Lanka's north, and I quote again, "The Sri Lankan military has become an army of occupation, physically and psychologically, if not legally. Now, much like the guerrillas before it, the military manages many aspects of everyday life and is the final authority on virtually all important decisions." Close quote. The government of Sri Lanka is using militarization in three ways. One, by numbers, where the sheer physical presence of the military personnel becomes an intimidating factor. Two, the use of civilians without proper oversight to gather information and intelligence on other members of the civilian population. And three, using the military for civil administration. Mr. M. A. Sumandran, Member of Parliament, said in October 2011 that there is one soldier for every 10 civilians in the Jaffna Peninsula in Sri Lanka's north, 1 in 10. Retired Colonel R. Hariharan of the Indian Army, doing a military analysis of the amount of soldiers in the northern province, calculates the ratio of military personnel to civilian as 1 to 6. The government of India, the UK and US too have publicly called for reducing the presence of the army in the north and east and bringing it to the levels which it is in other parts of the country. The presence of big groups of military personnel among civilian population breaks the social cohesiveness of those populations. Governments have understood this not only in Sri Lanka but in other parts of the world as well. For instance, if protests over a people's grievances are to be neutralized without addressing those grievances, one way of doing it is through intense political and military repression. A model put forward to understand this phenomenon is to compare the social body to the human body, and subjecting society to repression is interpreted to be similar to that of torturing human beings. Societies traumatized by repression only worry about day-to-day survival, so that pursuing long-term political ideals becomes secondary. It is similar to humans under extreme physical stress who focus mainly on escaping suffering. While demolishing the general population's urge to cohere as an effective political organization, governments also destroy emerging leaders around whom resistance to repression coalesces by eliminating them selectively. Second, an important objective of political repression is gathering intelligence. And in this task, the military, assisted by the police and intelligence networks, use their ubiquitous presence in the north and east for surveillance. Paramilitaries and those once detained under suspicion of being LTT members and are now released are also used extensively for this. While paramilitaries are routinely employed with military informants, ex-detainees are either innocent civilians taken in during security roundups in the past 3 decades, or LTT cadre who surrendered after the rebels' military defeat in 2009. Following their so-called rehabilitation, the ex-detainees are resettled and asked to spy on their neighbors to provide information to the military. There is a good, if tragic, reason why ex-LTT detainees do this. A group of students from the University of Virginia's Law School was in Sri Lanka in January this year for field research on human rights. According to a report, which is available on the net, the so-called rehabilitation of the detainees included repeated beating, intrusive interrogation, and other forms of intimidation. After this period of rehabilitation, they were allowed to resettle, hopefully in their villages, but still treated as suspects. The students record that even after resettlement, they undergo harassment and intimidation. For one, they are issued special identity papers. They have to report regularly to the police or military camp in their village. They have restrictions of movement because they cannot leave without informing the authorities. There are also home visits by military officials, and many of the resettled express fear of leaving women and girls alone at home due to unexpected visits by the military. By acting as informants, the military, the paramilitary and ex-LTT detainees create deep levels of mistrust within Tamil society in the north and east, because people become deeply suspicious of each other, as no one knows the loyalty of one's neighbors. Therefore, this strategy of pacification destroys the cohesiveness of the social group. The third set of issues connected to militarization I wish to deal with is the way the military has taken over functions that are traditionally the preserve of civilian officials. For instance, under Sri Lanka's scheme of devolution of power, and I will deal with this more extensively in a few minutes, the representative of the central government in each province is the governor of the province. In Sri Lanka has 9 provinces. Of these, only 2 have ex-military personnel as governors, the North and the East. One of them is retired Major General G. Chandrasiri, who is now governor of the North. While in active service, the Major General was commander of the Northern Region. The governor of the East, retired Rear Admiral Mohan Vijay Vikrama, was head of the Eastern Naval Command while in active duty. In other words, only in the provinces with a Tamil-speaking majority are decisions on planning overall policy, whether it be demining and resettlement to issuing permits on fishing or quarry, comes under the overall purview of an ex-military officer. Military officers see the world through a lens of national security, which is usually a hindrance to post-war reconciliation. Such a lens becomes worse when military officers are asked to govern in a civilian sense and not command people who only 3 years ago they saw as enemies. Societies that were hotbeds of armed rebellion need time to cool, and ex-soldiers devising policy that negates community healing in favor of shoring up state security does not help. There are also many other examples of how militarization in the North and East, for instance, its impact on the freedom of movement and speech of Tamil opposition political parties in that area. Militarization is also routinely constrains civil society activity, from a ban on Human Rights Day demonstrations in December last year to demanding that all meetings of NGOs require government permission, and private activity, even that as such as a religious ceremony or even a birthday party, where more than two people gather, needs security clearance. We can speak about all that more during Q&A. What is clear from all this is that the government is using the massive military presence in Sri Lanka's north and east to intimidate the population. First, it intimidates them by arresting, detaining, and torturing groups of people so as to dissuade them from coalescing effectively for political action and knocking off potential leaders by arresting or disappearing them. Second, the government uses signalization to create fissures in the collective identity of the northern and eastern society. This is done by using the largely singular military and police to assist singular settlements in Tamil areas and change the character of these areas through Buddhist and singular cultural symbols and social institutions. Let me now go to the second arm of the government's pacification program. This is sharing power with the Tamils. The model of sharing power in Sri Lanka that has currency today is through devolution to peripheral elected units. Known as the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, it was proposed as part of the Indo-Lanka Accord. The accord was a treaty signed by New Delhi and Colombo in 1987. It is important to note that the 13th Amendment was passed in Parliament and is law today. However, due to successive governments' reluctance to implement all its provisions, not all powers have been made operational. In substance, the 13th Amendment devolves power to the 9 provinces of Sri Lanka. However, it is important to realize all power devolved to the elected provincial council assemblies is under a unitary form of government. This means that although provincial councils have the freedom to implement policy on, say, agriculture or education or healthcare or industries, there are a number of controls exercised by the central government, which is a huge restraint on the autonomy of these councils. One of the important constraints is that the central government has the power to dissolve the councils and take over the administration, citing national emergency. Due to these constraints, Tamils long acquainted with how the central government, dominated by Sinhalese, works, have expressed fear that devolution under a unitary form of government will always be under threat of being undermined. They have demanded a federal structure with a concept of shared sovereignty written into the constitution. Soon after its military victory over the NTTE, the Sri Lankan government showed a distinct distaste for negotiating with the Tamils on sharing power. In fact, the president and his brother, the hawkish secretary of the Ministry of Defense, as well as extremist Sinhala parties in the government, have opposed devolution in the form of the 13th Amendment. They have either called for its repeal on the plea that it could be a platform for further secession, or they have demanded a homegrown constitution, which means that they characterize the 13th Amendment as an Indian imposition. Later, however, due to sustained pressure by the US, Britain, EU and India, the government finally agreed to begin negotiations on sharing power. Negotiations began with the largest Tamil political party in parliament, the Tamil National Alliance, or the TNA. The TNA, while expressing reservations about devolution of power under a unitary constitution, agreed to begin direct talks nevertheless. However, the TNA insisted that if talks were to progress, two provisions in the 13th Amendment that successive governments were reluctant to implement had to be on the table for negotiations. One was land powers, which gives provincial councils power over land vested in the councils, and two were police powers, where provincial councils would have power over the recruitment, transfer, and disciplinary control of junior officers of the police. The government rejected discussing both subjects in direct talks. Meanwhile, the government came up with a new idea. Instead of direct negotiations with the government and the TNA, a parliamentary select committee, the government said, would be appointed. A parliamentary select committee is a special committee appointed from time to time by parliament to study important issues. The members of the committee are members of parliament. The number of positions each party gets on the committee reflects its strength in parliament, meaning the number of seats a party has in parliament. The government said that it would appoint such a committee to study power sharing through the 13th Amendment and invited the TNA to participate in its proceedings. The TNA refused on two grounds. One, that all such party mechanisms had been tried before, and each of these mechanisms had been scuttled at the last moment because of a lack of political will. Two, in the year and a half of talk that had gone on before the call for the Parliamentary Select Committee, the government had not delivered on a minimum of agreements that they had agreed. Having described briefly the devolution to the 13th Amendment and problems of implementation, let's ask the question. Why is the regime in power using militarization and centralized political control to rule? The main reason is that the government wants to continue in power. The only way such continuation for generations to come is possible is by governing through undemocratic means. Governing while violating democratic norms has created the government many enemies. Therefore, more suppression is needed to keep the perceived enemies at bay and have a pacified population that will not revolt. Sri Lanka's political leadership today rests in a single family, President Mahinda Rajapaksa and his siblings and their children. The consolidation of power in one family has been at the expense of not only sharing power with the Tamils and the Muslims, but even with the elected opposition that is largely Sinhalese, and even members of Rajapaksa's own party. This has made Rajapaksa many enemies. One such enemy is Sarath Fonseca. Fonseca is a retired army commander and is seen as the man who led the Sri Lankan military's victory over the NTT. Fonseca contested against Rajapaksa at the 2010 elections and for this act alone was labelled a traitor. He was later arrested, charged, found guilty by a court-martial and civilian courts on what is generally seen as trumped-up charges for corruption and then later imprisoned. Last year he was released to serve the balance of his 3-year sentence from home. Fonseca had many who were sympathetic to him in the army, who paid for their support by being thrown out of their jobs. Because it has acted undemocratically, the government has to face dissent. And the only way it knows to deal with dissent is by using the military and other law and order apparatuses to suppress it. And while realizing a huge military in southern Sri Lanka could be an embarrassment and possibly a threat because it is near the country's political capital, the government stations the military in the north and east on the plea it has to assist in rehabilitation and resettlement of the war-torn areas. While stating that the incumbent regime has a special fascination for imposing tight control on the north and east of Sri Lanka through the military and centralized political authority, we have to also understand that such sentiments are not confined to this government alone. It has been seen consistently during the country's post-war independence period from 1948 onwards. For instance, numerous non-violent protests, mostly in the north and east, but also outside, were brutally dispersed by the military. Therefore, the Rajapaksas have not innovated anything in suppressing Tamil aspirations by subjecting an unarmed population to an untamed military. They have merely enhanced its scope. It is no different in the question of sharing of power. In the run-up to independence, a key demand by the Tamils was power sharing at the center, where a consociational model was proposed to ensure some parity in parliamentary seats between the Sinhalese representatives and the numerically smaller national groups such as the Tamils and the Muslims. When that was rejected, an alternate way of sharing power was proposed by the Tamil leadership. This was by sharing power at the periphery in the areas where the Tamils and Muslims formed a numerical majority through a quasi-federal system. It was when both systems of power sharing were routinely rejected by successive Sri Lankan governments that the Tamils demanded secession, first democratically and then through armed insurgency. But this did not mean that while armed rebellion was going on, the Tamils had abandoned experimenting with constitutional models to see if their political aspirations could be accommodated within the larger constitutional architecture of the country. This is the reason why the 13th Amendment, much maligned by all, still is very much at the center of the debate on how power should be shared between different nationalities in the country. But that does not mean that was the only model that was tried. An earlier government came up with a draft constitution in the year 2000. Then in 2006 and 2007, the 13th Amendment was subjected to serious reappraisal by a body called the All Parties Representative Committee, or the APRC. From that exercise, a report was compiled that could have been a good starting point for negotiation with the Tamils. Needless to say, both documents are rendered marginal to the debate today. What frustrates Tamils is not only that negotiations on power sharing have failed, even in the full implementation of something as minimal as the 13th Amendment. It is because of the new ways the government keeps devising to centralize power that should actually rest with the North and East Provincial Councils. For instance, a government minister today is trying to do away with the 13th Amendment altogether and replace it with a new amendment. And because the government enjoys a two-thirds majority in Parliament, there is a frightening prospect that it could succeed. This brings me to the final part of my presentation. How do these political trends impact on reconciliation with the government promised at the end of armed combat in May 2009? Very adversely, I'm afraid. On the one hand, militarization has created deep misgiving in the Tamil population, because the Tamils believe they are subjected to a brutal physical and psychological repression manifest in disappearances, arrest, torture and sexual harassment. The repression is enhanced by attempts by the military and the administration to transform the collective identity in the North and East by erasing cultural symbols and social institutions. But while the Tamils resent militarization, it appears that the military too is unhappy. A revealing article in Sri Lanka Ceylon Today, 2 Sundays ago, reveals the frustration of the army working for civilian resettlement in the north and east of the country. A soldier speaking to the newspaper complained about bad food, having to take pay cuts for uniforms and training programs, as well as highlighting soldiers wounded in the war and undergoing rehabilitation now and how they were virtually bereft of care. He targeted the lack of care and compensation by the military for its foot soldiers on the Tamils. He said that while the government wanted the Tamils to build shelters resettling Tamil civilians, families of poor Sinhala soldiers remained destitute. This shows that using the military to do work that they were not recruited for with poor pay is not only a source of frustration to the Tamil civilians but to Sinhala soldiers as well. Neither attitude obviously helps reconciliation. Worse, the last 30 years has taken a huge toll on democracy in Sri Lanka. The present constitution concentrates power in the executive presidency, directly elected by the people. The president is head of state, head of cabinet, commander-in-chief, usually the head of his or her party, appoints senior judges, bureaucrats, policemen and policemen and policewomen, and even heads of state universities, among other bodies. Increasing power in the hands of the presidency has led to politicization of a number of key institutions, such as the police and the bureaucracy. The media has lost its independence. On top of that, due to 30 years of war and long years of military repression in the North and East, key institutions have been allowed to go to sea. The police and military, accused of crimes of extrajudicial killings, disappearances, and torture, have almost never been held accountable, which means that they can act with impunity. The judiciary almost never questions the police if it brings suspects charged under the Prevention of Terrorism Act, leading to many people being held without charges indefinitely. I would like to illustrate the way institutions have gone to seed and how authoritarianism has violated democratic norms by one example. A few months ago, the government tried to pass an urgent bill, the Divinaguma Development Bill. The bill sought to centralize powers over rehabilitation, resettlement, and most importantly, development of the north and east of Sri Lanka in the hands of one person, the Minister of Economic Development, who is a brother of the President. The bill went before the Supreme Court to be ruled on its constitutionality. The bench, with the Chief Justice presiding, said in its order that since the scope of the bill affected the provinces, it would require the assent from the provinces too before becoming law. The court did not throw out the bill. It only wanted changes made to the procedure on its passage to becoming law. The President and the Parliament criticized the judgment as an affront to the judiciary and supremacy of Parliament. But without amending the legislation, or even substantially debating the relationship between the judiciary and the legislature, Parliament is now trying to impeach the Chief Justice on the grounds of financial misappropriation and the abuse of power. Moving swiftly, it has appointed a Parliamentary Select Committee to probe the conduct of the Chief Justice. The impeachment process in the Constitution is weighed so heavily against whoever is being impeached that people hardly have a chance. So much so for democracy in Sri Lanka. Therefore, rather than set the stage for a conciliation, not only has the end of armed combat made ethnic and national rivalries in certain ways more intractable, it has also brought into relief other conflicts, all of which pertain to a deficit of democracy in the country. Given that there is a consolidation of power within the country which represses any sort of opposition and creates drivers of conflict in a way that this trend, is there any way that this trend can be reversed? Right now, if a reversal of this trend is going to happen, much of it will depend on the international community. What then can the international community do? There are three areas that are critical for reconciliation and conflict transformation in post-war Sri Lanka, in which the international community can weigh. One is that the international community should help to bring to an end militarization of society, especially in the north and east, but in other parts of the country as well. Military personnel not required for peacetime functions should be confined to barracks and eventually demobilized. It is true the international community has called for demilitarization of the north and east to be made on par with levels in other parts of the country, but that is obviously not enough. Second, there has to be accountability of all parties to the civil war, both government and rebel. And that accountability should be a credible process and take the form of an independent international investigation. Finally, the international community should call for a better system to share power between the Sinhalese and Tamils that goes beyond the 13th Amendment. It has to be something where the relations between the centre and units that is guaranteed by being written into the constitution and not left to people in the central government to change at their whim and fancy. In order to be effective, the international community should have a clear-cut plan of action with benchmarks and consequences for the government of Sri Lanka if the government does reverse its undemocratic trend. This is because in the past, the international community has not maintained sustained pressure on Sri Lanka when it has demanded change, and the consequences of such ad hoc policies have given the impression that the international community is not serious in its demands for democracy. If the international community is seen as genuine in backing for democracy in Sri Lanka, and it is there for the long haul, then such actions will have two consequences. One, it will rein in the worst excesses of the government. Second, it will give courage to those activists who are struggling within the country to continue their struggle for democracy. In such an environment, it is possible that government will understand that the only way to survive in Sri Lanka is to follow the democratic path and work to end the drivers to the conflict. Thank you.
Okay, I'd take some questions now, and I'll ask Manny because I think he has to leave.
Yeah, so, take off.
Yeah. And please identify yourself before you ask the question.
Manny Tuttle, I'm director of the Asian Studies Program. I really like the talk, it's very informative. I have two questions. First, you mentioned the encroachment of Sinhalese and Tamil in areas that are considered to be traditionally Tamil, part of the Tamil homeland. Right? So I'm wondering, I know that this was an issue prior to the outbreak of conflict, right, with the institution of the Mahaveli River Project and the settlement of these areas with by Sinhalese. And I'm wondering if this continues, if what you're talking about in your, when you mentioned this, if what you're talking about is a continuation of that trend or what happened previously. In other words, is there a continuation of this policy to resettle these areas or to settle these areas with Sinhalese? And I guess the other question I have is about the state-military relations. I'm wondering just how much of, just kind of projecting out, how much of a threat to the internal stability of the Sri Lankan government, you know, aside from whatever is going on with minorities in the north and east, to what extent does this tension between the government and the military represent a substantially destabilizing force in Sri Lankan politics?
Thank you for those questions. Well, yes, the settling people or settling Sinhala people in Tamil areas has been something that has been taking place in Sri Lanka from the 1930s. In fact, from that time onwards, the whole idea was to use resettlement in ways whereby there could be a dilution of the character of the Tamil areas. One way of doing that was, of course, imposing a Sinhalization of the cultural and social symbols. The second was a sort of diluting parliamentary representation from those areas. When you had more Sinhalese settled in those areas, you found that there were not as many Tamil members being returned to parliament from those areas. So now that is continuing. But that is continuing in areas where it was not there before. For instance, in various parts of the east and north. Now, what happened during the war was that they carved out areas and called them high security zones. They remain high security zones even now. I mean, people can't go in. I mean, the people who are displaced from those areas can't go in. So what they do is to create camps and settle Sinhala families in and around them. So basically, the scope of the whole colonization, or what they call resettling mass populations of Sinhalese in Tamil areas, has increased. Now, secondly, coming to the whole question of resettling people in the Mahaveli areas, there it was slightly different, and that is also taking place. But what I would like to say is that resettling people in the Mahaveli areas had a military strategic reason. Because if you might remember that that particular area where they that was known as Mahaveli, Mahaveli by the way is a huge irrigation scheme in Sri Lanka, which was sort of you know, it was expanded during the 1980s so that you could have so that it could water areas which were not being watered by the original Mahaveli River. But what they did was to plant colonies, as they call them, in a very strategic area called Manalar. In Tamil it's known as Manalar, they call it Valley Oil. The whole idea was that it would bifurcate the contiguity of the Tamil population. So it was at the settlement was in the slightly south of the neck of the peninsula. So those things are also going on. But now I think the idea of settling people for military strategic reasons, like because the war with the LTD is over, is of less consequence rather than settling Sinhala people in the Tamil areas so that there could be a dilution of the character, of the Tamil character of those areas. Coming to your second question, state-military relations. Well, see, one of the things that has been happening in the last 5 years or so has been that the ruling family has been able to get all the reins of the different strands of power into its hands. So the person who is now in charge of the military, that's the secretary of the Ministry of Defense, is the brother of the president. So what they are trying to do is to see that there is no, I mean, everyone, including the military, is completely under the hands of the ruling family. So, in an ideal military, perhaps there should be a civilian commander in chief, like say in this country. But there, in Sri Lanka, although the president himself is a civilian, because of family connections, you get a different dynamic at work. So what they try to, now for instance, as I mentioned, you know, Sarath Fonseca, this guy who was taken in and put in prison because after the last election. As far as we know, he was not planning a coup. But what they said was, he's planning a coup, so it's going to destabilize the state, so therefore he has to go into prison. And with him went lots of other people who was his supporters in the army, who were thrown out of jobs. But as far as we know, there was no real fear of that, because the military was in, at least the defense secretary, that's the brother of the president, was in charge. So my feeling is that there is no real fear of a coup or anything like that. It is because these guys are in full control, but they use it to increase repression and against people whom they don't like for in the case of Sarath Fonseca. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
If I may actually reclaim my chair status to ask a question before I go back up. May I had to leave, so I let him ask the first question. Two questions. One is, you know, you mentioned that power sharing and its failure was one reason why the Tamil grievances started and evolved in the way it did. But also, I know that along with that were specific policies instituted right through the 1970s that chipped away at the rights of Tamils, including admission to universities, jobs, and so forth. And those were specific things that were also adding to the grievances. Is that, to what extent is that policy continuing, and do we see that continuing even after the conflict? And the second thing is a bigger question about the rising authoritarianism, which goes beyond the ethnic conflict. And again, in the 70s and into the 80s, Sri Lanka has had periods of very strong authoritarianism, one where the executive president became stronger and stronger. And then what you saw, because of Sri Lanka's, I think, traditional democratic history and traditions, there was a backlash. And what happened is that they had to pull back, and in fact then, you know, and a lot of that came from other Sinhala opposition parties. So I'm wondering, in today's context, what is the possibility? Because it's just that they're trying to be in power for the, you know, next generation, but to what extent do you think that's leading to some sort of countervailing?
Yes, thank you for those questions. Well, the whole idea of sharing power, both power sharing at the center, which I mentioned through a kind of a consociational model, and later power sharing through devolution of power to the peripheral units at the north and east, is based on the fact that the Tamils thought, or Tamils believed, that they would not find justice in the hands of a single majority. Because they thought that if they were going to be part and parcel of the Sri Lankan state, and be at least the of Sri Lankan society, and be equal, they could not, I mean, there could be no discrimination due to language. There couldn't be discrimination in admission to state universities. There couldn't be discrimination finding jobs. But what they felt was that this discrimination had become almost endemic. And if they were going to be part and parcel of the same country, the only way they could sort of ensure that they had an equitable access to resources would be where their leadership, Tamil leadership, could have power. So the consequence of this type of discrimination was that they demanded a different kind of power structure. But when that didn't work, now for instance, in 1972, the then Federal Party, just before a new constitution was drawn up in 1972, they participated in the Constituent Assembly, saying that they wanted federalism. That was a model that they put forward. But they were basically just laughed out of the assembly. So then they just realized that not only was there structural discrimination within the country that was being against them, there was no way that they could get out of that, because power continued to be centralized, which meant that they were being pushed from both sides. On the one hand, that there was discrimination. On the other hand, there was no way they could share power in a way that they could, that at least in the areas where they were dominant numerically, they could sort of set up their own industry, they could sort of work in their own benefit. Speaking about rising authoritarianism, yes. You see, from about the 1980s, there was rising authoritarianism. It reached a culmination in between 1990 and 1993 under a president known as Premadasa, Ranasinghe Singh Premadasa. But then there was a backlash. But very interestingly, the reason why the backlash took place was that Premadasa himself was assassinated. He was killed by Jalhit. But then, having said that, that doesn't mean that, it's very difficult to speculate how things would have happened if he had continued to live. But having said that, the president who succeeded him, Chandrika Kumaratunga, now she was looked upon as a paragon of virtue when she first came into power. I mean, and in fact, she got 64% of the vote, and most of those votes came from the large percentage of those votes came from the Tamils. But what happened? In her quest for power, she began tightening up again. So, to me, the main problem here is the constitution itself. I mean, part of it is perhaps is partly the political culture of the people. I mean, it takes them a long time to revolt. They don't sort of fight against authority. On the other hand, if the constitution is made in a way where there are proper checks and balances and stuff like that, it would be difficult for a president to assume such power. The problem here is that the constitution is written in a way that gives the president all power. So you have a president who is not willing to play by the rules. You find that power of the other institutions erodes. So I think one of the things, so in my mind there are two things that are needed. One, I feel, is that there should be a constitution which does not allow abuse of power. I mean, all constitutions allow a degree of abuse, but I think there should be much better checks and balances. The second thing is, I think much of the political character, political culture that has come into this country, come into Sri Lanka, is because governments allowed abuse of power. As I said, now things like impunity. I mean, they just didn't want to prosecute policemen and military guys who were charged with rape or murder or torture of Tamils. Why? Because they are all, let's go along with it. So as long as that type of impunity is part of political culture in this country, of Sri Lanka, then we're pretty sure very little is going to happen. So there has to be accountability, so which is one of the reasons why I feel that there has to be accountability, both of the political leadership as well as the military leadership.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Considering the ethnic and geographic...
Could you just identify yourself, please?
Sorry, my name is Bob White. Considering the ethnic and geographic basis of the conflicts here, do you think there's a concern by some people who are in favor of centralization and who oppose sharing of power, that if power were shared, this might at some point lead to a resurrection of the Civil War?
Yeah, well, I think that has been the reason that is touted by the Sri Lanka government. What they say is that if there is sharing of power, the civil war might recur, and it might lead to another bid for secession. But I don't think that is quite correct, because for two reasons. One is, if you look at it historically, Tamils asked for secession or started fighting for secession when there was absolutely no other way whereby their political demands and their political aspirations could be met. So from 1948, in fact this goes on much earlier, so I don't want to go into that, 1948 was independent. From 1948 up in the mid-1970s, they used every way to see that their political demands could be in some way accommodated within the constitutional architecture of the country through power sharing and stuff like that, or even if it didn't get into issues of power sharing, whether they could sort of be accommodated at an administrative level and lower levels as well. When that did not happen, it was then that they asked for secession. So to my mind, if you go on repressing those people, if you say that, look, if any sort of autonomy is given to the Tamils, it will lead to secession, I think that is one good reason why it would fuel new conflict, rather than say, okay, let's give them let's give them autonomy at the periphery, that is, say, through a federal system, or share power at the center through a sort of consortium one. I don't think something like that would lead to any sort of interest on the part of the Tamils to revolt or secede. Because we should not forget that they've also gone through 30 years of war. I mean, which is the population that has gone through 30 years of war and seen unbearable suffering, that wants to go to war for no reason at all? So my analysis is that the government is talking about the Tamils wanting secession to increase militarization and to keep power from the Tamils, rather than accommodate their demands to a point and see that all communities are treated equally.
Sean
McGill. In your talk, you spoke a lot about the military and you mentioned the police actually fleetingly. And I was sort of curious if there's any interest on the part of the government of over time, you know, decreasing the number of actually boots on the ground, essentially military, and then trying to build up a more professional, say, local police or not. This is anything. And one reason I ask that, it picks up on the last issue you brought up of autonomy. Autonomy is a word which means many things to many people, but is there an idea of, does the government have any idea of giving autonomy in certain particular areas to the Tamils, but not in others? I mean, when you look at where, after civil war, sometimes the peace has come, the conflict has ended, it's precisely by offering, in, say, the cultural realm, a certain realm of autonomy, but not in others. Thanks.
Well, basically, there has been absolutely no accommodation or no interest in, up to now, in offering autonomy to the Tamils, either politically or, I mean, well, basically political autonomy in the north or the east of Sri Lanka, where they are numerically concentrated. In terms of police, say things like police powers, for instance, I don't think there is any reason why, like under the 13th Amendment, which I was talking about, there can't be devolution of power where the provincial assemblies can recruit or transfer and disciplinarily control junior police officers. The whole idea when this 13th Amendment was drawn up was that you have a population from the north and east who would have policemen of that area. I mean, of course, when you push that too far, also you get problems because it leads to corruption and stuff like that. So you had higher level police officers, I think over the rank of ASP, Assistant Superintendent. I don't think the same rankings operate in this country, but basically from mid rank upwards would be people who are recruited by the central government, whereas at the junior levels, it would be people of the area. But that was completely rejected. So there has been no interest to either reduce militarization or even sort of accommodate some of the wishes of the non-majority communities by saying, okay, you can recruit lower ranks of military officers or police officers, stuff like that. One of the things that they have tried to do is to sort of recruit Tamils into the police and into the army. That has been something that they have done. But it's more kind of show, you see. I mean, the moment that is done, it's flash in the newspaper. Oh, here we are doing some, you know, we are trying to accommodate the wishes of the minorities. We are being pluralist and this and that. But nothing happens. Yeah, I mean, we know for a fact that about 2 years ago, a contingent of Tamil policemen for came from Jaffna. That is the capital of Sri Lanka. It's the biggest, most important part of, most important city in Sri Lanka's north, Tamil dominated, who came, I mean, they were supposed to take part in Victory Day, march past on Victory Day. And when they came, they were issued orders by the second in command of the police that they do not take part in the Victory Day parade, because no one knows why. But the fact remains that they did not take part. I mean, this became a public issue. So these things happen. I mean, they say that, okay, we are going to recruit so many people, a few hundred people or something like that. But finally, the other question is, even if you recruit junior officers into the military and the police, if decision making continues to be in the hands of senior officers who are Sinhalese, And in a power structure that is, and a state that is openly sort of monoethnic, the recruitment of, say, police and military officers of a junior level actually will not change much, which is what's happening.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, yes.
No, take the mic and defy yourself.
My name is Maitri Jagadish, and I think what you mentioned about the police is very interesting. I was in Nurelia district working with upcountry Tamils, and whenever a Tamil boy was taken in the police force, it was shown as a very direct link between militarization and economic development. So can you talk a little bit about how the government is talking about economic development, particularly in the north and east or minority areas? And then how the international community, if they can engage the government on any sort of areas that you mentioned, this idea of demilitarization and, you know, pushing this, you know, pushing away from centralization. What is that link, and then how can the international community address that?
Well, thank you. Basically, one of the problems with economic development in the North and East is what I mentioned. Because, you see, post-war, what the government has been trying to say is that we will give the areas of the North and East economic development. We will develop the roads, we will develop highways, we will develop railways, we will develop hotels, blah, blah, blah. But the question is this. It is one thing to develop all these, you know, infrastructure. The second thing is, the more important thing is, who controls them? Now, we know for a fact that much of the construction itself is dominated by, not by people of the area, but by people that are brought to this area by contractors from Colombo, that is in the singular area, basically. So, second, even when these have been constructed and they seem to be up and running, most of the staffing doesn't seem to be from the area. So even as an instrument of, you know, trying to win the hearts and minds of people, I don't think very much is happening, because the population, the local population, see that this is a kind of, you know, lovely hotels in areas which they once, one of the other things which I forgot to say, was that in many areas where these hotels are coming up, the people who were originally settled there have been displaced, they've been pushed out. And here they see huge hotels and roads and all this infrastructure development taking place, but they themselves have no part in it. So the question is, how, even as a way of developing fraternal ties between the government and the Tamil population, this is no help at all. The second issue is that I believe that the problem within Sri Lanka, what is known today as the ethnic problem, if you want to call it that, or problem between two nationalities, whatever, is basically an issue of identity. And I really don't know whether developing infrastructure and, you know, economic development actually helps in this sort of thing. When it comes asking the second part of your question about the international community, how it can sort of help in economic development, one of the things that the Tamils have been always asking is that the provincial councils also have some degree of control over finance, which would also include possibly asking for foreign aid directly to foreign governments. Now, that sort of thing, if there is a constitutional model that would allow that sort of thing, that would be very helpful. Because the experience in Sri Lanka has been that all foreign aid, and foreign investment, is channeled through the central government. And when the central government is it's discriminatory, much of the money that comes in doesn't go into development of the Northern East, but it goes into other areas. I mean, this has happened all the time. In fact, I can also say the same thing happens about NGOs. You know, the NGOs that come into in the Northern East to want to sort of do rehabilitation projects and stuff like that, basically have to channel some of their money, or much of their money, through the presidential task force. And the presidential task force even tells you who the beneficiaries should be. So how are you going to have any sort of development, or for that matter, proper rehabilitation?
Thank you very much. We're actually out of time, so I'd have to bring it to a close. But please join me in thanking the speaker for a very eye-opening presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope it's not. I wanted to throw something.
Yeah, no. I think
it's
just I wish there were more people who are seeing the presentation and just create that maybe in the next few weeks.